Good morning, everyone. We just want to thank everybody who helped put the breakfast together. We want to thank all the ladies that helped set up all the tables, helped make all the eggs, helped put all the trays together. Thank you very much for all of your help. We want to thank Mrs. Berg for getting out there to get all the bagels. Thank everyone for all their help to put everything together. And especially, we want to thank Rabbi Miller for traveling all this way. All the way from south of Dempster. There's somewhat of a vortex south of Maine. It's very hard to be able to cross Oakton even. I mean, it's literally, it's a challenge. So, but with all seriousness, we really want to thank Rabbi Miller for making it to come here. Obviously, he's very busy, and we appreciate him coming out here to give us chizuk. We're all so familiar with his tremendous speaking abilities, with his fantastic stories, with the tremendous messages he gives us over Tisha B'Av, and we're even more excited now that we can really welcome him. As opposed to Tisha B'Av, where we're somewhat limited in what we're able to say, so we're all the more excited that he's able to come and speak today on the legal holiday, speak about winning friends and influencing people, which obviously is an important topic. There's an interesting piece I saw the other day, Reb Schwab on Tefillah, in his Sefer on Tefillah. Schwab writes that if you look at the pasuk within Asher, when we talk about when one is looking for parnasa, when one is looking for sustenance. So we throw in this funny word. We say, so I ask Shrav, he says, what does Ratzon have to do with it? He says, why do we add the word Ratzon by the will? What does will have to do with Parnasa? So Shrav writes something very fascinating. He says, the truth is, you can find people who are tremendously qualified for their jobs, or all sorts of things, are tremendously qualified people, but yet it's very hard for them to find Parnasa. He says, part of the most important thing, the most important level of being able to find Parnasa is having Ratzon, that people have a desire to be with you, have a desire to like you, have a desire to work with you. He says it's almost the most important thing, and we're privileged to hear words from Rabbi Miller about this exact topic, about how to win friends, how to influence people, and for all of ourselves, how to be a proper mashpia. We just learned the parshas between this week and next week. We learned the parshas of Yehuda, who's going to become the melech, and we understand that even though maybe we're all not cut out to be the king of Klal Yisrael, but we all have our personal places where we have to make a difference, we have to make an impact, whether it's in our homes, our families, our schools, wherever we are, we're all in the same places to make an impact. And now, without further ado, we have Rabbi Miller to give us the chizuk of exactly how to do that.
Thank you, Rabbi Yoren, for the kind words of introduction and for inviting me to speak today. I just want to thank Rabbi Nirman Babiner for being the shadchan, arranging the talk, and Mrs. Berg, who I haven't met. Did she get today? Oh, thank you. For the flyer. And as Rabbi Yoren mentioned, it's also very, very great. I'm grateful to be invited to speak in the Kollel on a day that isn't Tisha B'Av. You know, I lost count, but I think it's over 10 years that I come on Tisha B'Av and I speak by the Kinnis and try to give some meaning and inspiration and relevance to the Kinnis. And somebody observing the scene might get a wrong impression. I mean, you don't serve any food, everyone sits on the floor, and no one looks happy to see me. So hopefully today they'll get a better impression of the Kollel. Okay, so the title of the talk was advertised, a Torah version of winning friends and influencing people. Now, I need to preface my words with a few points of introduction. The first is that although I've actually been working on this informally in my head for a couple of years now, it's very much a work in progress. And there everywhere I turn, I mean, Rabbi Yoren here mentioned the pasuk in a commentary from Rav Schwab. I say Asher every day. In fact, I've read Rav Schwab's book on Tefillah. Somehow that comment just went right past me. But the truth is, there are so many places where we see in the Torah principles that are found in Dale Carnegie's book. And about 30 years ago, when I first started working in outreach in Buffalo Grove, back then I was doing it full-time, someone advised me to read the book, and I read it. I read it about a half a dozen times. And I have to say, it opened my mind to a completely different way of interacting with people. It made so much sense, but I was bothered very much by one thing. And that is that we are taught, as Torah Jews, that all truth is found in Torah. That doesn't mean you can't find truth outside of Torah. But any truth that you find in the world is going to be in Torah. I didn't see, at that point in time, I didn't see any of these principles of interacting with people in the Torah. And then if it's not in the Torah, that means it can't be true. But it sounds so right. So I started paying attention. When you maver the seder, when you learn, or you learn a Gemara, and all of a sudden you start realizing it's all there. It's all there. So it's a work in progress, and over the past number of years, I have given this talk two other times. And every time I give it and I work on it some more, I come up with more sources and more stories. And so I'm going to ask you, if any of you have, after listening to what I say, you have a story to share that highlights these points, or another Gemara or another Chazal that talks about these points, or to clarify a point, I would ask you, please, that you can call me or email me. Not going to be able to stay too long after the lecture today, maybe just a few minutes for question and answers, but I actually, right after the lecture, I'm running out to Appleton, Wisconsin to make some more of Lamer's milk. So, you can contact me, and I would be very much interested to hearing what you have to say. The second point is, I have to give a disclaimer. I am also a work in progress, not just the lecture, but I'm also always constantly trying to realizing. Sometimes a spouse or family members help make you realize that, you know, you're violating one of the principles that you yourself preach. And normally a person should gets up and gives a shmooze, they should be on the level of that shmooze that they're giving. And anyone that knows me well knows that I, like everybody else, like all of us, we're all a work in progress our entire life. And if you see me violating one of the rules, don't be disappointed. Don't be disillusioned. I'm trying, but we all have work to do. As you know, as you may know, the phrase, How to Win Friends and Influence People, is a title of a book published by Dale Carnegie. This book was actually published 80 years ago. And it's since been published in almost every single spoken language around the world. It's sold hundreds of millions of copies. It's a perennial bestseller. And there's actually a Dale Carnegie Institute that offers classes and seminars to businessmen to help them in their professional development. There's one more point that I need to clarify, actually two points I need to clarify. And the first is, the title, How to Win Friends and Influence People, we need just to define for ourselves. Is that a Torah ideal? Is our goal in life to win friends and influence people? In the secular world, people are judged by how many friends they have on Facebook, or how many followers they have on Twitter, or how many people watch the YouTube video that they posted about their cat playing the piano. That's not something that we aspire for. A Jew does what's right, whether he's going to win him or her friends or not. You do what's right. So is the premise that Dale Carnegie puts forth, is that a Torah ideal, something that we should spend time on? And I believe the answer is yes. The Torah does want us to master the techniques that the book gives, if done for the right reasons. Dale Carnegie writes very clearly in the beginning of his book that one of the main reasons and the main benefits of learning these techniques is that it will help you get a better job. And if you get a better job, you'll make more money. And if you make more money, you'll have a better life. Now, for someone that's not a Torah Jew, that's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. But we have a lot more that we aspire to as Torah Jews. Our entire life should be getting closer to Hashem, making a Kiddush Hashem, making the world a better place, not necessarily to make more money. So we have to know that we do have a little bit of a different agenda than Dale Carnegie, but the techniques are still very valuable to follow and to learn. Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Kol sheruach habris nocha imenu, if people and their actions are pleasing to other people say, oh, this fellow is a nice person and he does nice things, then ruach hamokom nocha imenu. So then Hashem will be pleased with that person. Again, this doesn't mean, as we say, you don't do what other people want you to do. You do what's right. But when you do what's right, there's a way to do it with diplomacy, to do it with sensitivity, Not to compromise on halacha, and yet do it in a way that respects other people. And when you do that, and you maintain your principles, but you show sensitivity and affection and diplomacy for other people, so then they will respect you, and they will, as the Mishnah says, they will be ruach habris nocha imenu. They will have a high regard for you, and then Hashem will have nachas from you. And say for Orchas Tzadikim, it's a famous handbook on, on the character development, on midos, it says that when a person acts correctly, they will become ohuv, they will become beloved to all people. And then he continues, and so what? Who cares if you're ohuv to all people? He says, and then if you're ohuv to people, then people will look up to you. They will want to be like you. And if they want to be like you, you will be able to influence them in the proper way to act. And so it will be a Kiddush Hashem for you. You'll make a Kiddush Hashem. You'll influence others to make a Kiddush Hashem. And Hashem will have nachas from everybody. So yes, winning friends and influencing people is a proper ideal. I once heard from a friend of mine, he said, if we were to write the book today, we would give it a different title. We would say, How to Win Friends and Influence Yourself. Because that's really what we need to do. We're not so much worried about influencing others. We worry about influencing ourselves, making ourselves the best possible person that we can be. And then, yes, ultimately, that will cause us to be able to influence others. Well-known, the Chofetz Chaim used to say in himself, he lived to be in a ripe old age, he said when he was younger and he was full of energy, the Chofetz Chaim wrote, besides in his famous books, the Mishneh Berurah and Shmiras HaLoshim and Chofetz Chaim, but he wrote dozens of other smaller books, larger books, and he said in himself when he was younger and he was full of energy and he was full of plans how to change the world, it was his goal, literally, to change the world. He got a little bit older and he realized that's not so realistic, because he has to really work on a smaller circle of people. He should work on the Jews of Radin, his hometown where he lived, and he should work on Radin, the Jews of Radin, to uplift them and make them the best people. He got a little older, he realized, you know what, that's also too ambitious. He needs to work on his family. He got a little bit older, he says, you know what, let me try to work on myself before I leave this world. Now the Chofetz Chaim worked on himself and became the tzaddik and the Talmud Chacham and Gadol B'Torah and Torah leader that he became, because he worked on himself. And then he changed the lives of his family, and he changed the Jews of Radin, and he changed the world. But it came not because he was looking to influence others, but rather to influence himself. So this is a little bit of a different spin that Dale Carnegie has. But again, in terms of the techniques, they are very, very valuable. And we should try to learn them and master them. There's a second practical reason why we should try to learn these techniques. There's a Medrash Tanchuma in Pinchas, Parshas Pinchas, that makes the following fascinating observation. He said about human relations. We all know that no two people look exactly alike. Everyone in this room, everyone looks different. There are hundreds of millions of billions of people in the world, and everyone looks different. The Medrash says, just like God created us, each one to look different, everyone also has a different personality. Just like exterior, and our exterior, we all look different. And our interior, and our personalities, and our thoughts, and our opinions, we also are all thinking different. What the Medrash is saying is as follows. Did you ever see one person walk over to another person, all upset, and yell at him, why don't you look like me? I look right. You should look like me. No one would say such a thing, because everyone understands that I look the way I did because God made me look this way, right? Maybe I had some, you know, some plastic surgery, but basically I look this way because God made me look this way, right? He looks his way because God made him look that way. So we don't get upset when someone looks different than us. But why do we get upset then when someone thinks different than us? We have to realize, if I think my way, and I'm certain that my way is obviously the correct way, we have to realize that's not only me. God had a big share and me thinking that way. My thought process, the way everybody knows that this is true between men and women. Men and women just think differently. But it's also true with every single individual. God made people think differently. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody's opinion, everyone has their own truth, and everybody's opinion is okay. I, God forbid, don't mean to say that. Nowadays, we're witness to people coming up with ideas and philosophies that are literally breaking down the moral fabric of society. I would never have believed, and I don't believe anyone would ever believe, and when it comes to a time that we're going to debate who is a male and who is a female and what kind of lifestyle is appropriate, just because somebody comes up with a philosophy and an opinion, if they're making that philosophy because it's just to justify their base desires or perverted desires, that the Torah does not have any patience for and does not give any credence to. What I mean to say is that if somebody makes an objective effort, an honest effort to think through something, and comes to a conclusion that's different than yours, you have to realize that person's opinion has validity, even if we don't want to necessarily surround ourselves in a bubble with everyone who just thinks like us. We want to be able to interact with other people. Other people have other opinions, just like they look differently, they're going to think differently, and it's important to learn the skills how to interact with other people. Unfortunately, we see, not just in the Jewish world, in the secular world, but also in the Jewish world, we see a breakdown of the ability that we have to discuss and connect with people that disagree with us. We do exactly the opposite. We go ahead and we cloister ourselves in a bubble, and we don't want to hear. In the political world, we see this happening. Democrats and Republicans, they can't talk. They can't work together. Where one says one thing, the other is automatically going to say the opposite. 10 years later, that other person is going to say the same thing as a position 10 years ago, and now all of a sudden the opposition says the opposite. It's like that in the secular world, and unfortunately that attitude has crept into the Torah world. I remember growing up, Chicago was a much, much smaller community then, and we couldn't afford, and we didn't have the diversity of having so many different schools and of education. There were three day schools, but in my day school, the principal of the day school was a Lubavitcher Chassid, and one of the heads of the day school was the Weizner Rav, who was a Satmar Chassid. And in our classes, which were relatively small classes by today's standards, there were all kinds of Yidden that came from backgrounds, from not from backgrounds. There were all kinds of Yidden. One of my closest friends at the time is today a big Hasidic rabbi in Miami Beach. And we were all together, with the growth of our society, which is a tremendous blessing, we have today schools that service different segments of the community, and that's not a bad thing. But what's a bad thing is that we somehow think that it's wrong to have any kind of interaction within each other. We only talk within our own group, and that's not a good thing. We need to be able to learn how to interact with other people. We would be surprised if we develop these techniques. We can have honest discussion. We'd be surprised that we could influence others, and we could become influenced by others, and that's all a good thing as long as we're doing it the Shem Hashem. So with all of these introductions, let's try to get to a couple of points. We're going to discuss a few points today and hopefully a few points next week. I'm not going to follow necessarily the order of Dale Carnegie's book. I'm really just following an order that I made up on my own. Not that this order is better than that, but just some of the orders, how they came into my head. One of the first, I find, most important things when you want to try to influence somebody is to offer them a sincere, meaningful compliment. And this is something that I myself, the way Hashem made me, it's a little bit of a challenge to compliment people. But it's something which is so, so basic. If you want, especially when you want to try to convince someone to change their behavior or to change their opinion, you need to be able to find a way to compliment them. And we find this in the Torah. I'll just give you one example just from the parshas that we've been reading. Yehuda approaches Yosef in Parshas Vayigash, and he's going to give him an entire passionate talk to try to allow Binyamin to go back home. He wants to influence Yosef. He doesn't know it's Yosef he's talking to, this viceroy of Egypt. He wants to influence Yosef to change his mind, let Binyamin come back home. What's the first thing that he says? He says, Ki chamocha ki paro, because you are just like Paro. Now, many people seem to know one half of a Rashi. Rashi says, you know what it means? You're just like Paro. You're a scoundrel like Paro. You're a liar like Paro. God is going to punish you like he punished Paro for abducting Sarah, Imenu. Right? This is the Rashi that everyone knows. The Rashi does say that, but you know what? People don't realize it. And I know this because I've said this to many people and said, where does Rashi say that? Rashi says that is not the pshat of the pasuk. That is the drash of the pasuk. And the lashon of Medrash, that is the meaning of the pasuk, but that is not the literal interpretation. Rashi says another interpretation is the literal interpretation. What's the literal interpretation? He was giving Yosef a compliment. He said, I want you to know, I hold you in very high esteem. even though I'm going to try to debate with you, don't think that I'm debating with you because I'm not machshiv you, but I don't consider you to be a very worthy person. You are, in my eyes, I hold you in the same esteem as Pyro. Pyro was, for all practical purposes, the most powerful person in the world. Mitzrayim was the world's superpower. Power was the undisputed leader of Mitzrayim. So Pyro was the most powerful person in the world. And I want you to know, Mr. Mishnah LeMelech, your viceroy, I want you to know I hold you in the same esteem. Why did he say that? Because, again, he didn't realize he was talking to Yosef, but he was hoping to make Yosef realize, you know, I want you, you're a very chashuv person. People need to hear that. They feel more secure in their position with you, then they'll be willing to open up their minds and be influenced. And as we see, that worked. Now again, it worked because one of the reasons it worked is because Yosef was Yosef. And it was really just a charade, all the cruel things he was doing, the strange thing he was doing, was all a charade. But had it been a genuine viceroy that wanted to imprison somebody, this kind of talk, the Torah tells us this to tell us that this is the kind of way we need to start off when we try to talk to someone to influence them. Maybe those who live in Skokie that find it difficult to travel south of Oakton. Maybe you've never been in our post office in West Georgia, in Peterson Park. We have a post office on Devon Avenue. Right, I know. When I made a chasana, I came to Skokie to mail my invitations. I didn't mail it over there. So about 30 years ago, there was a survey of post offices around the country in major cities. For some reason, the post office always has a very, very poor rating by the public. Personally, I think it's a little exaggerated, but people love to hate the post office. That's the way it is. And from all of the major cities in the country, Chicago scored lowest in terms of customer satisfaction and public approval. Chicago scored the lowest. And from all the post offices in Chicago, the one on Devon was the lowest. I'm not making this up. Now, anyone that has ever been into the post office earlier than 10 years ago will know why. For one of the reasons why. There was a worker there. His name was Thomas. I don't know his last name. His name was Thomas. That whenever he would speak to a customer, he would literally bark at them. He would always yell at them. Now, one of the reasons why is he happened to have had a booming voice. That's just the way he was made. He had a booming voice. But in addition, there's a difference when you boom at somebody with a smile or when you boom at someone with a frown. And he was always frowning. He was yelling at people. They didn't have the form filled out correctly. They didn't have the package sealed correctly. They weren't getting their wallet out quick enough to pay. Whatever it was, he was always complaining to people. Now, I was standing in line. I had like 4 or 5 people ahead of me. And I had just read the books. This goes back. I had just read Dale Carnegie book. And I was looking for opportunities to try it out. You know, it sounded all good on paper. Everything's gone good on paper. So I was standing there, and I said, that's it. I am going to watch him. I'm going to observe him. And I'm going to come up with a way to give him a compliment. And I'm going to see what happens. I had a good 15 minutes. There's only 4 or 5 people in line. I had a good 15 minutes. Okay? And I was watching him, observing. When it was my turn, there was a different clerk that was open. So I turned to the fellow behind me, and I said, you know what? I want to get serviced by him, so I'll let you go ahead of me. He gave me a look like I was suicidal or something. Why in the world would I want to do that? Okay. So then, a few minutes later, Thomas was open. I walked over to Thomas. I leaned over the counter, and I whispered to him. I said, I want you to know that really I had a turn earlier, and it was going to be with a different clerk. I specifically gave up my turn in line because I wanted to be serviced by you. You want to know why? So he looks at me and says, yeah, why? So I said, because I was watching you. And I see that all the other clerks, they move so slow like a snail, which is another reason why it's a very unpopular place. Everybody is moving. They open up the drawer like this. They take any money. They count out the stamps one by one. It's like everybody is moving so slow. And you finish off the customers 1, 2, 3. And I appreciate somebody that works with efficiency, and therefore I wanted to be serviced by you. So he didn't know what to say. He gave me a huge smile, and he says, "You know, you're right. I really like it when people work quickly, and it just bothers me so much when everybody's moving so slowly. So thank you very much for the compliment." And we did whatever I transacted, whatever business I had to do. And I ended and I left him and I said, "Thank you, Thomas, have a great day." And I want you to know, for the next 15 years, about 10 years ago, he retired. So you won't see him, it's safe now. So, you know? But for the next 15, 18 years, every time I came into the post office, which was pretty regularly, I would try to get service by him. But if I got service by someone else, I made sure before I left the post office to stop by his station and just say to Thomas, "Hi, have a great day." And he gave me a smile and have a great day. And he never, ever barked at me. He was barking. I didn't change his behavior with anyone else. He continued to bark. But with me, he was a very pleasant person. And it was, what did I do? It was such a small thing. But it meant so much to him. Those of you who know me and my family know, my family, as truth is, many, many of you maybe, were very big fans of Rabbi Pesach Kron. Whenever he speaks, we like to listen to him. He writes a book. We buy the book right away. Especially when I was out in Buffalo Grove on a weekly basis for Shabbos, I would take the book and we would, besides for the Divrei Torah and the Parsha, I would read a story of his at every Shabbos meal. And we would read the story and we would dissect the story and talk about it. And he's an amazing person. Really an amazing person. Besides for his speaking ability and his writing ability, he happens to be an amazing person. If you get to know him personally himself, he's an amazing person. And so about 7, 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, you know, time flies faster than you want it to. It was about 10 years ago, and he came out with one of his books. I said, "You know what? I like the book so much. I'm going to send him a thank you letter." So I sat down. He knows me a little bit. We brought him out to Buffalo Grove two times. And he, of course, he was very... well received over there. So I wrote him a thank you note, and I made a comment about one of the stories in the book that I had a personal knowledge of. 3-4 days later, I get a phone call from Rabbi Kron. He's thanking me for my thank you letter. So I said to him, "Rabbi Kron," I said, "you know, that, you don't have to thank somebody for a thank you letter, then I'm going to have to thank you for your thank you letter." And besides, I says, "I'm sure you don't have time to thank everybody that sends you thank you letters." So he said, "Yitzchak, I want you to know something. I know that everybody likes my speeches because people come to listen to them. I know that everybody likes my books because Art School tells me that they sell very well. But I want you to know I never get a thank you letter. No one ever thanks me. After a speech, people will walk over and say, 'Thank you, it was a great speech.' But no one will take the time to thank me in a letter. And therefore, your letter was very precious to me. I wanted to call you to thank you." Can you imagine? Big Rabbi Kron, you think, "Oh, he doesn't need a thank you. Everybody's thanking him. Everybody needs a thank you. Everybody needs a compliment." One of the consequences of, as again you may know, besides, my work in Buffalo Grove is a little bit more part-time. It's more than just part-time. It's just very peripheral. There are people that are living in Buffalo Grove today that are picking up the slack and doing tremendous work. I still teach there a little bit, but my main job nowadays is being a mashgiach for kashrus. As a result of that, I often don't daven with a minyan. Most of the cities that I go to are very small communities. There's almost none of the cities have a Torah community. Many of them don't even have a Jewish community, not an Orthodox community. In Appleton, there's a handful of Jews with a Reformed temple that meets, I think, once a month. So I don't have a minyan to daven. So I daven myself. I try actually to daven a little slower to compensate. At least I can have better concentration, better kavana during the davening. But often, I'll go an entire week. I'll leave town Sunday morning, and I'll come back Thursday afternoon. Thursday night, I give a class in Buffalo Grove, and then I would, most of the week, I just don't have a minyan. On the days that I happen to be in town, I'll go to a certain shul. They have a shacharis at 8:30 very often. If I come back in town, I'll come back like 2 in the morning. So I allow myself the luxury of going to an 8:30 shul. Most of the members in the shul of that minyan are retired, so you know they're getting up a little later. Now dive in that shul. Frishachas. There was a fellow a number of years ago. There was a fellow who was in Avelis. He was in the early morning, and he was davening for the Yomit every day. And he, from, I guess also his schedule worked out that the 8:30 in that show worked out good for him. So whenever I was there during that year, he was davening for the Yomit. And I had a really big problem, because he davened extremely quickly. There was no rabbi there at that 8:30 minyan. The rabbi had davened at an earlier minyan. And if it wasn't like it wasn't a Monday or Thursday where there's laning and a longer tachnun, he would finish davening in 32 to 33 minutes. It was just a very, very fast minyan. And I felt very frustrated. First of all, you know, it's 8:30. If someone's rushing to work, they should daven in an earlier minyan. It's, people that are retired, they're not rushing. This fellow, for whatever reason, found it convenient, but it was just way too fast. And I couldn't daven that fast. I often would have to skip parts of davening in order to daven Shmoneh Esrei with a minyan. So again, I wanted to suggest to him, without criticizing, because as we'll talk about perhaps next week, criticizing is almost never effective if it's done not the right way. So I didn't want to criticize him, but I wanted to come up with a suggestion how he should please daven a little slower, at least when I'm there. Now, I had an additional challenge, because this fellow was, as many Yidden are, he was a very opinionated person. And he had never had, whenever, I really didn't have anything to do with this person. We didn't daven in the same shul. Our children didn't go to the same schools. I didn't really have any connection with him. I just knew who he was, and he knew who I was, but it was not really much of a connection. So I had to think of a way to connect with him, because why should he take a suggestion from me when he doesn't know me? So I was thinking I have to find a way to compliment him. But his personality, the fact that he was a very opinionated person, whenever I would pass him by, he was always giving his opinion to whoever he was talking to. It happens to be a behavior it's just not my style. To put it politely, that's the way Hashem made me. I'm not someone that feels that everybody has to hear my opinion on this. But I had to recognize that that's the way Hashem made him. And so I can't say that behavior is wrong. There might be a right and a wrong way to act, but I can't say that behavior specifically is wrong. So I needed to find some way to connect with him so that he would accept my suggestion. I really thought about this for a few weeks, and I was a little stumped. Finally, Hashem helped me put an idea in my head. I called him up. His name was Yonah. His name isn't really Yonah, but we'll call him Yonah. I says, Yonah, hello, my name is Yitzchak Miller. I'm sure you know who I am. He said, yeah, I know who you are. So I said, listen, first of all, I noticed that you're davening for the Amud. That means that you're an Avelis. Can you tell me which relative you said that you're an Avelis for? So he told me he lost his father a few months ago. So I said, you know, I didn't know your father. He doesn't live in Chicago. Perhaps you can share with me 2 points about your father's life that you think would be worthwhile for people to learn from and be inspired from. So he was very happy. Who doesn't have something nice to say about their father, hopefully? And so he shared with me 2 points. The truth is, I don't even remember what they were. They were nice points. He shared them with me, which is a technique that we'll talk about either a little later today or the next week. And so then I said, Yonah, I have a favor to ask you. I have a problem, and I don't know how to solve it, but perhaps you'd be able to help me solve the problem. Now, I want you to know that before I tell you my problem, I want you to understand that I couldn't say this problem to most people. Because most people, they're not confident about themselves, and when I would offer some kind of a suggestion to someone that's not confident, they'll become very defensive, and they won't want to listen and accept it. But I happen to know that you are very confident about your opinions because you always share them with people, and that's wonderful. So I therefore want to ask if I can share an opinion of mine with you. So he hesitated. He thought I was giving him a compliment, which, you know, I said it the right way, I think. So then I told him, I says, listen, most of the week I don't have an opportunity to dive in with a minion. Unfortunately, that's my job. And once in a while, I'm able to get home a little earlier in the week, and I daven at this minyan, I'm sure you sometimes see me. And when you daven there, I'm not able to daven as quickly as you are. I did not say that you were davening too quickly. I just said, I'm not capable of davening as quickly as you daven. And therefore, I like to ask a chesed, just one Jew to do another Jew a chesed, that perhaps if you happen to notice me in the shul, in the congregation, when I'm davening there, can you just slow down just another 3-4 minutes, not a long, just 3-4 minutes, just to do a chesed to another Jew that I can daven a little, you know, to be able to keep up and daven Shimon Esrei together with the shul. So he said, of course, why not? I mean, you're asking me to do a chesed for a Jew. Who wouldn't want to do a chesed for a Jew? Mm-hmm. Absolutely, no problem. And again, for the next 4 or 5 months that he was in the year of Havelis, whenever I daven there, he would slow down. Did he slow down when I wasn't there? I don't know. I doubt it. But when I was there, he slowed down. And you know what? Ever since then, it's been already 6-7 years, ever since then, whenever we pass, our cross pass in the street or in a shul, we'll not say, hello, how are you today? Nothing more than that. But beforehand, we didn't even do that. Now, you know, he remembered, he did something good for me. I was open with him about my feelings. And so we're able to go ahead and say, hello, how are you? Have a good day. And all it was, again, was a little bit of a compliment. So this is, I'm not saying that this is the most important thing, but this is one technique, when especially, it's always good to compliment, whether you have to correct somebody or not, it's always good to compliment. But especially when you need to offer a criticism of somebody, the first thing you should do is first offer one of the things you could do to get them to be receptive, to open up their mind, to accept the suggestion or the criticism, is simply to pay a sincere, substantial compliment. The next idea, something similar but a little bit different, is to take an interest in a person's life. Listen to them, ask them questions, and listen to them. Everybody has things in their lives that are weighing them down. It might be financial issues, it might be health issues, it might be family issues. There's a host of issues. Every single person is walking around with a weight on their shoulders that they feel is ready to crush them. And just one little bit more, and they don't know how they'll be able to take it. And if you think that is an exaggeration, I used to think that was an exaggeration. I read that once in a Rabbi Yisrael Miller book. He was for many years the Rav in Pittsburgh. Now he lives in Canada, not related to me. He wrote that in a book, and when I first read it, I thought that was an exaggeration. When I was working with people in Buffalo Grove, I saw that is not an exaggeration at all. Every single, you look to the person to the right, to the left, every person, not at every second of the day, and not every day of the year, but generally in their lives, there are issues. Everybody has issues that they're grappling with. And if you take an interest and show them a listening ear, so they will be so grateful, then they'll be willing to accept a suggestion or a criticism of theirs, because they'll have such respect and sense of hakaras hatov, of gratitude, the fact that you were willing to take an interest in their life. Again, I'll show you this from a Rashi, that I've said this to numerous people, and again, for some reason, this is a Rashi that everyone glosses over. We know that when Avram was sitting outside his tent at the beginning of Parshas Vayera, and Hashem came to visit him, so he was visited by 3 angels. The pasuk says that the angels asked Avram, where is your wife Sarah? And the word ayo Sarah ishtecha, where is your wife Sarah? That the word is ayo aleph yud vav. There are, if you look in the Sefer Torah, there are dots on that word ayo. Rashi says that they intended to do two things. First, they intended to make Avram realize, of course he realized it, but they wanted to show that they realized that Sarah was a very modest person, and that she was working in the tent. That's one thing. And that everyone remembers. But there's an additional message that they wanted to give Avram. And that is that they wanted to show an interest in the welfare of Avram's family. And the Rashi says that they did not only ask Avram about Sarah's welfare. The pasuk says they asked where she is. But that's just indicative. What they really were saying, that they had a more extended conversation, is how is she? How is she doing? To show Avram that Sarah was an important person and they were concerned for her welfare. But Rashi says that they also then went to Sarah and they asked Sarah about her husband, Avram's welfare. And they said that is derech eretz. When a person is a guest in someone's house, you're not supposed to go there, take their food and eat it, and then perhaps go take a bed and sleep in it. You interest yourself, you involve yourself in the welfare of your host. They're doing you a chesed. They're offering you benefits of shelter and housing, whatever it is that they're giving you. You should also repay it by asking and showing an interest in the lives of your hosts. And you ask your host about the hostess, and you ask the hostess about the host. It's interesting. The Torah, you'd say, the angel is speaking to a lady. Oh, no, the angel wouldn't speak to a lady. That's not, Rashi says, that's exactly what happened. They took an interest in it, and they asked about the welfare. And that's what people need to do. When you speak to somebody, you should realize, that here, Avram and Sarah, maybe they didn't have pressing issues. I mean, they had a pressing issue that they desperately wanted a child, which is something that they were going to give, the angels were going to give a bracha for. But they weren't asking for a specific reason, like they needed Avram to unburden himself. It's just derech eretz to take an interest in other people. I will share with you one of the most unusual compliments that I ever got in my life. Those of you who don't me know that I have a tendency, I forgot the medical term, it's very easy for me to contract cellulitis. When I get cellulitis, for whatever reason, oral antibiotics don't work initially. As soon as I get cellulitis, the doctor gives me orders that I have to run to the emergency room, I have to get on intravenous. If I'm on intravenous for a day or two, then I could go off of it and take oral medication. But for some reason, initially, oral medication doesn't work. So I've had it over the past 30 years. I've had it a number of times, maybe a dozen times. And the doctor tells me I shouldn't even call him. Just rush to the nearest emergency room, have the emergency room contact him, and he'll give the okay to put me on the IV. There was one time when, foolishly, I waited too long, whatever the situation was, I waited too long, and I ended up being in the hospital for a week. One day, in the afternoon, it was a room with two beds in it. In the afternoon, they brought in an elderly fellow, about 75 years old, and he had collapsed, he had fainted, in front of his apartment building that he lived in. And they brought him to the emergency room, and they did all kinds of tests, and they could not find anything wrong with him. He seemed perfectly fine. Blood pressure, everything seemed fine. But they wanted to keep him overnight for observation just to make sure that there was nothing wrong before they sent him home. And so he became my roommate. So, of course, you know, I asked him his name. He told me his name. He asked me my name. I asked him what happened. He told me, you know, that he had fainted. So for the next hour and a half, different nurses and staff members kept coming in, and they were poking him and prodding him and doing all kinds of additional testing to see if they could find something. And after about an hour and a half, they left, and we were left alone. So I asked him, you know, does he have a family? He said he was married for many, many years. He and his wife never had children. His wife passed away about 7-8 years ago. And he moved in. He had a sister who was never married. And after his wife passed away, both he and his sister needed a little bit of assistance. They decided, you know, they would move in together, share an apartment together, and they would take care of each other. And then he broke down crying. And he said, but now I'm all alone. And it literally started wailing. I didn't know what he meant. So after a few minutes of crying, he explained to me that his sister had just died. And he made arrangements for the funeral. And they had the funeral. And he had come home from the cemetery, and he was standing outside his apartment building. And he realized he's going to go back to his apartment, and he has nothing to look forward to. He's going to be alone now the rest of his life. And the pain of that realization was so intense that he fainted. And he continued to cry. So I pressed the nurse's button. I had the nurse come and I said, you know, you took all these tests. I'm wondering if anybody of the staff questioned him and realized that this is what he was going through. And she said, no. She looked at the record. No, they didn't really ask him about this. And so they consulted with the doctors, and they realized that, you know what? Again, most likely, it simply was this. There was nothing else that was wrong. But they kept him overnight for observation. Almost that entire night, this man had a captive audience of one, and he shared with me his entire story. He served in the army. I forget which army it was. If it was the Korean army, I don't remember which army it was. World War II? I don't remember. Tell me about the different jobs that he had. He was a security guard in a bank. He was this, he was that. Tell me about his wife. Literally went through his entire life story. And the truth is, it was fascinating. You know, everybody's life has fascinating parts to it. In the morning, after they were going to release him, had him sign the papers, put him in a wheelchair, and they were wheeling him out of the room. And he says, Rabbi Miller, you would make a great bartender. You know, I missed my calling. But it made me realize, you know, that's all the person needed. He needed an ear. Everybody needs companionship, and everybody needs to be able to embrace. Everybody has worries. They have worries, and they have desires, and they have unfulfilled dreams, and they want to be able, or they have fulfilled dreams. They want to be able to share it with another person. This is the way Hashem made all of us. And if you take the time to show a concern for other people, and you take the time to listen to other people, then when you need to do something to influence them, to correct them, they'll be receptive. Yosef HaTzadik was in jail. And in the jail was the Sar HaMashke, Sar HaOfer, was the butler, the baker. And each one had a dream. Rashi tells us that not only did each one have a dream, but each one also dreamt the interpretation of the other one's dream. Meaning that the butler, besides with his dream, he dreamt the answer to the baker's dream. And the baker, besides with his dream, dreamt the answer to the butler's dream. They were sitting in the morning there, all depressed, not knowing what to make of the dreams. Yosef comes in, and he sees that they're depressed. And they ask them, what's going on? Why are you so depressed? And they each one unburdened themselves and told them their dream. And Yosef told them the correct interpretation. Now, if you think about it, each one, Yosef also had his problems. Yosef also had every legitimate right to look depressed. He was in jail for a trumped-up charge. He was framed for something he did not do. He was taken away from his beloved father. He was taken away from Eretz Yisrael. He's being sold as a slave. He was subject to terrible, terrible nisyonos tests from Eshes, the wife of Potiphar. He had plenty to be depressed about. And he went and he noticed somebody else and he asked about them. And as a result of that, that was the ingredient that got him out of jail 2 years later when Pharaoh had a dream. But the butler and baker, they were sitting there depressed, wallowing in their own problems. If one would have turned to the other and said, hey, how come you're so sad today? And he would say, well, I had this crazy dream. And then the baker would have said, oh, you know what? I dreamt the interpretation to the dream. They could have solved each other's problems. They didn't do that. Because everybody is busy and engrossed in their own problems. They don't take the time to realize, you know what? Right now I can't do anything about my problem. But let me share my friend's burden, or my wife's burden, or my spouse's burden, or my boss's burden. Let me involve myself with other people, and you will gain their admiration, respect, and then when you have to influence them to do the right thing, you'll have a listening ear. The next detail, and again, this is somewhat similar, but is that you need to express, besides for expressing a compliment, that could work, but something that's also very powerful is to express your affection for the other person. Obviously, in a way which is appropriate, there's one level of expression, if it might be a spouse, a parent, a child, and another level of expression which is appropriate for a worker, for a relative, for a neighbor. But if you express an affection for the person, a way of identifying with that person, and that you have a genuine love or like, whatever the appropriate expression might be, then again, you'll be able to make that person very receptive. Yaakov Avinu, he's sitting in the Beis Medrash of Shem and Aver for 14 years, and then he comes out and he goes to his uncle Lavan. He comes to the city where Lavan is living, and he sees groups of sheep with their shepherds lounging around by the local watering hole, by the local well. And And he sees them just, to him it appears that they're just wasting time. Now Yaakov is a person of emes, of truth, and he couldn't tolerate people just taking, not working, not giving their full energy to their employer. So he starts to tell him, you know, it's not, why are you sitting around here? Water the sheep, give the sheep water to drink, and then go back. So they explain to him, well, we can't unroll the rock. But Yaakov Kamenetsky, he points out that before Yaakov offers this criticism, he says one word. He says, Achai, my brethren, my brothers. And he says, why aren't you giving the sheep water to drink? It's not time yet to bring the sheep in at the end of the day. There's still a lot more time left at the end of the day. Why aren't you doing your job and then go back to the field with the sheep? And he says that word, Achai. Rabbi Yaakov says, why is he adding the word Achai? He doesn't even know them. And the answer is that he was trying. He realized, why should they accept criticism from a complete stranger? So the word Achai meant a lot more. The Torah just says one word because the Torah is very stingy on words. When he said, Achai, my brethren, he spoke to them to connect with them in a way that they wanted to feel that he's a brother. What the words that he used is not relevant. It's just teaching us the message that before you offer a suggestion or a criticism, do something to express your affection for that person, that you care for their feeling. Many of you may know there's a big tzaddik who lives in Eretz Yisrael, but David Grossman, he's the Rav of a town in Eretz Yisrael called Migdal HaEmek. Today, he's a very, very well-known, a very well-respected rabbi. He's one of the most respected people in Israel, even amongst secular society, secular Jews. But many years ago, when he was first starting out in his career of activities, he had a title. He was called the Disco Rabbi. Why in the world? Why would you call a rabbi a disco rabbi? And the reason why is because what he used to do was he would go to the discos in some whatever city he was on a Saturday night when the disco was filled with teenagers, and like a Pied Piper, he would go in there and he would somehow convince the teenagers that were whatever they do in the disco to follow him out, and he would teach them Torah and he would make them Balei Tshuva. And you have to wonder, how in the world did he do that? Like, I can't do that. Yeah. How did he do that? What magic powers did he use? If you ever spoke to him or watched a video of him speaking to people, you will see it's because he oozes Ahavas Yisrael. He just loves every single Jew, every single person. And it just is so apparent from every word and every mannerism of his that you just can't help but be enamored by him. And I'm going to tell you the following story. He told this following story himself to a friend of mine. He said he has a, now he's the Rav of Migdal HaEmek, he has a major kiruv center in Migdal HaEmek, and he has to raise money, millions of dollars a year. He needs to raise money for all of the kiruv activities. And he was flying to America to raise money. Now, he had, just prior to this, he had won something called an Israel Prize. It's a prize awarded by the Israeli government for an individual that does a tremendous amount to better Israeli society. And so he had won this prize. One of the benefits of the prize is that you could fly El Al first class for the period of a year, I don't know how long. And so he had never flown first class before because normally he buys the ticket. But this time he was flying first class. He had never sat in a first class seat before. But he had sat down in the seat and he noticed one or two rows in front of him, there was a fellow, a not Jewish fellow, a very famous pastor by the name of John Hagee. I don't know if you've heard of him. Tell the story. I never heard of him, but he's a very famous pastor in San Antonio, Texas. And he has one of these mega churches where thousands of people come to listen to him in person, and then his sermons are broadcast all over the world. And he happens to be an evangelical type of a pastor. He's very supportive of Israel, and he raises a tremendous amount of money to donate to Jewish causes in Israel. And so this John Hagee had just spent, this Pastor Hagee was telling Rabbi Grossman, you know, I had just spent 10 days in Israel. I had taken money that I had raised from my church, and I was I came to Israel to distribute the funds to different Israeli organizations. So Rabbi Grossman, not thinking that he was going to get any money from this pastor, but says, you know, I also happen to have an organization where I help underprivileged youth people that come from broken homes and they're living on the streets and they have all kinds of problems, whether it's drug problems or social problems or crime problems, and we take them and we rehabilitate them. And I happen to have a CD that shows the work that we're doing. Would you like to see it? So he said, yes. Rabbi Grossman brought him over a CD player and a CD, and he started the CD. It was about a 15-minute CD. Then Rabbi Grossman went back to his seat. After 15, 20 minutes, Rabbi Grossman came back to this pastor to take back the CD. He put his arm on the armrest of the seat that Pastor Hagee was sitting on, not realizing that there was a button there that would fold the seat out like a bed. And this John Hagee, if you ever saw pictures of him, he's a very large person. And all of a sudden, the seat flopped down, and he literally made a backward somersault and fell out of the seat. And Rabbi Grossman felt he wanted to just crawl into a hole under the floor. He felt so embarrassed that here he embarrassed this pastor. So he promised the pastor, believe me, he never flew first class before. He didn't know that there was even such a button. Please forgive him. And the pastor was very gracious. He said, no, it's fine, it's fine. And then to show his attempt to mollify the feelings of the pastor, Rabbi Grossman gave the pastor a big hug and a kiss on the cheek, which is that's how Rabbi Grossman is. And he gave him a big hug and a kiss on the cheek. And then he sat down on his seat, and he just wanted to hide in his own embarrassment. A few minutes later, the pastor came over to Rabbi Grossman and said, I wanted to tell you something. As I mentioned to you, I came to Israel with a tremendous amount of money to distribute. And I get the red carpet because people know that I come with money. I've come before with money. And I was shown, the prime minister met with me and other Knesset officials. They took me to various different programs. And they were all very nice programs. But there was nothing that really caught my fancy. There was nothing that made me really excited that I gave the money. So I said, you know what? Each place that I went to visit, I said, you know what? I'm going to consider your place. I have other places to visit. And perhaps when I get back home, we'll make a decision and I'll let you know. But I really didn't know what to do. I wanted really to distribute the money before I came back home. That was my purpose in visiting. But while I was waiting in the terminal, I turned to my wife and I said, you know, I don't know what to do. We haven't given away any of the money. And so he said to his wife, he's going to make a prayer. And he prayed to God. He said, God, I need a sign from you to show me who I should give the money to. So the next person that tells me about his organization and he gives me a kiss, I'm going to give him my money. And here, 10, 15 minutes later, I got on the plane, and you gave me a kiss. It's a sign from God. He took out his checkbook, and he wrote Rabbi Grossman a check for $2 million. Now, as the Chazal say, Yesh lo mona ratzon masayim, Rabbi Grossman didn't cancel his trip. He still went to America to raise money, because he needed more money. But he's $2 million he got from Pastor Hagee. Because he gave somebody a show of affection. Right? So if you want to go ahead and try to convince someone, don't throw stones at them. Don't yell Shabbos at them. Show them affection. Show them that you are valued in their eyes. And don't do it because you're going to get $2 million. Do it because it's the right thing to do. You don't do any of these techniques to manipulate other people. You do it because it's the right way to act. But ultimately, the result will be that you will have a positive impact on people. The last point we're going to say for today is, besides for showing affection and offering a compliment and taking interest in them, do something for them. Do something concrete for them. Yosef, he interpreted Paro's dream. And then what does he do? He gives Paro advice. Now, if you really want to know how to save yourself and save your country, tell me, you know, collect all the grain during the 7 years of plenty. So all the Mefarshim ask, who asked Yosef for advice? Yosef was asked to interpret the dream. Why is he going ahead and giving unsolicited advice to Paro? And the simple answer, I believe, is very simple. Yosef was never given a get-out-of-jail card. He was told to come out of jail to interpret the dream. But it was very possible that after he interpreted the dream, he'll get a yashakayach from Paro, thank you, and then he'll go back to jail. He wasn't freed from jail yet. He wanted to do something for Paro so that he would make himself needed. He had every right to have an ulterior motive. He wanted to get out of jail, he realized, now Hashem took him out of jail to show him this dream, to interpret the dream. So he said, you know what, Paro? I'll give you also some good advice. And Paro said, you know, that's really good advice. You be the one to carry it out. If you want to go ahead and influence somebody, do something substantial. Again, I apologize that many of these stories are about me. It has nothing to do with me. But I one time had a fellow who was coming to classes in Buffalo Grove, and he enjoyed the classes. He davened in a shul that wasn't an Orthodox shul. But he came to classes. And then he was unemployed, and he was unemployed for over 6 months. And he was telling me, you know, how he's trying hard for a job, and he told me his skills, and it happened to be, it was really Hashem who put the idea in my head to make a contact with him and a person that I knew had employees in that with that skill set. And he had the interview, and he ended up getting a job. And he was so grateful, he said, Rabbi Miller, you know, I have to do something, not just for you, but for me, to thank you for getting me the job. And he said, what I'm going to start doing is, I'm going to start davening in your shul. I'm going to start davening in an Orthodox shul. There was just one problem. He lived 6 miles away from the shul. And he said, so what? I'm going to walk the 6 miles. He walked 6 miles. There were some Fridays that it was like weather like it is now, very cold. I had to call him up and tell him I'm using my rabbinic authority to prohibit him from walking the shul. Otherwise, he would have walked. What the weather was inclement weather. I would tell him not to come. But other than that, he would come to shul. Most weeks, he would stay in shul until the end of Shabbos, and then I would drive him home. Most weeks. There were some weeks he would even venture to walk back home, but he walked every day, walked all the time. And he said, listen, I didn't even ask him to do that. He did it on his own. Imagine if we go ahead and you offer help. The truth is, even if you're not successful, but you try to find the person a job, you try to help them, and you have siyata deshmaya, you can help them, but even if you don't, the fact that you try, people are very touched by that, and then they'll be receptive to a criticism, to a suggestion. Aaron HaKohen, we know. Why was he so beloved by everybody? Because he spent time making shalom between husband and wife, between different people, between different Jews. He spent time trying to bring shalom. People appreciated him. The following story I had heard many years ago, I didn't believe it. But then I was once at an outreach convention, and I met the rabbi that it was said about, and I asked him the story, and he said it's 100% true. So there's an outreach rabbi who lives in Montreal, who his job wasn't to do outreach. His job was to raise the money for the outreach organization. And he wanted to get an appointment with a person who was the owner of the Montreal Expos, which is the professional baseball team. The Montreal Expos. What? I'm sorry?
They moved away.
Oh.
They're not there anymore.
Oh, okay. So I'm dating myself. Okay. So he showed up at the office unannounced without an appointment. And he says to the secretary, I'd like to speak to Mr. So-and-so. Do you have an appointment? No. But you should tell their boss that there's a rabbi here, an Orthodox rabbi, that has a suggestion to change the lineup on the baseball team that you'll be able to get better results. So the secretary, this is a true story, he told me, his secretary went into called up on the phone and says, you know, Mr. So-and-so, there's this rabbi here, Orthodox rabbi, and he says he has a suggestion for the lineup, the Expos were doing that. So great. Yeah, he had a suggestion. So, of course, he was let in. So he said, you know, this fellow, he had studied the team. He was a very smart person. This person actually has written numerous for him on a very high level. But he studied the team. And he said, you know, if you change the person who's batting sixth to fourth and the person from third to second, whatever it was, I think you'll get better results. And he actually told the manager, the team, to do that. And they did improve. And what do you think happened? The owner of the Montreal Expos became a major supporter of the outreach organization. Right? So again, we're not going to be able to go ahead and do things like that. But again, everybody has troubles. Everybody has problems. And if you find a way to help them, first listen. And if you can find a way to help them, offer a constructive a suggestion for them, they will be so grateful that when it's necessary to try to influence them to do something or to offer suggest criticism, they will be receptive to you. So let's try to recap what we said. case anybody wants, I actually have a brief outline you can take from me when I finish. Let's just try to recap what we said, and then we'll end with a beautiful story. And the first thing is, we have to remember that this lecture is a work in progress, and again, I'm very looking forward to hearing your comments. Number two, we have to remember that the Torah wants us. It's not just El Karnaki. The Torah wants us to win friends and influence ourselves and influence others when it's done for the right reason. We have to remember that everybody has a different personality, just like they look differently, and we need to hear other people's opinions, and we need to learn from each other's opinions. We have to realize and remember and reinforce that all of the truths come from the Torah and come from Chazal, and we have the obligation to look in the Torah to find all of the ways for proper behavior to influence people. We have to remember the four points we mentioned today: to compliment people sincerely, to take an interest in their lives, to listen to them, to express your affection for them, and not just to talk, but to do something concrete to help them. These are the four points you mentioned today. God willing, one day I have this book that's waiting in my head to be written, a book of stories, and God, Hashem should help me, give me siyata d'shmaya to write it. When I come out with this book, you'll see, God willing, there'll be a chapter in there. The title of the chapter is going to be, I Was Standing in the Checkout Line on a Friday Afternoon. Okay. The reason for this title is because when I went out for about 8-9 years, I went every Friday with my family out to Buffalo Grove. We had a station wagon with his car top carrier, and we would take the cholent and plates and books and my children's clothing all out to Buffalo Grove, and many times my children would bring their friends, and we'd move into this house. We'd call it a seat house, and the minyan for the first number of years took place in the house itself. Later on, it moved to a storefront. And when we came out and we unpacked everything, we would almost invariably find that there were two or three items that we needed to get before Shabbos. Might have been an extra bottle of soda, a couple extra plates, a package of diapers. From a list of maybe 20 different items, each week there were two or three items. Around the corner from the seed house is a jewel store. And so almost every week, 30 minutes before Lech Benchen, I would be seen rushing up and down. I was able to rush a little faster those days. I would be seen rushing up and down the aisles. I knew where everything was, and getting those two or three items and checking them out. And there's something magical that happens a half an hour before Shabbos when you're standing in the checkout line. There are people. I would say half the shoppers in that store were Yidden, and they see a rabbi, and it's a half hour before Shabbos, and then the Shem Yisrael is almost bubbling to, you know, it's entering them, and it's bubbling to get out. They will come over to you and connect with you and try to show them that they're also Jewish, even if they don't observe the Torah like I do. And there were all kinds of interesting, fascinating conversations and incidents that happened while you're waiting in the checkout line on a Friday afternoon. So one time, I had bought my three items. I think it was a jar of filter fish and some forks and a bottle of soda. And I thought that the cashier had already checked, had scanned the gefilte fish, but I saw the same gefilte fish. So I said to myself, well, maybe by mistake I bought two of them. I didn't realize. And as I was holding the second jar, I heard a voice behind me saying, Rabbi Miller, excuse me, but that's my jar. So I turned around and I saw a lady, we'll call her Karen, and she had also purchased the same jar, and it was her jar. And I remembered her name, which is something that we'll talk about next week. I'd remember her name. And I said, oh, Karen, it's so nice to see you. This Karen had two sons that years earlier, had brought them. My wife used to do some children's programming while we were having a lecture taking place. We would have people could drop off their children, and she would do some kind of a project on the Parsha or the holiday, upcoming holiday. And so I said, oh, hey, Karen, how are you? And how's your family? And how are your boys? How old are they now? Now, this Karen was with a teenage girl, and she was telling this girl how I run the program, and her brothers would come to the program. Also, this lady, Karen, she and her parents lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. My mother, Allah Hashalom, had lived in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and my grandparents and this lady's grandparents were friends. And so she was telling her daughter about how the families go way back. As she was doing all of this, the cashier was just standing by listening. She stopped scanning and she was just listening to the interaction between me and Karen. All of a sudden, I hear a voice from behind Karen saying, Rabbi, were you ever a rabbi in Albany Park, at the Albany Park Hebrew Congregation? Now, Albany Park Hebrew Congregation, I closed up when I was a little kid. I obviously wasn't old enough to have been a rabbi in Albany Park Hebrew Congregation, but I looked at him. He just wanted an opportunity to reach out to me, to let him know. So I said to him, well, actually, I grew up in Albany Park, and I remember the congregation, but it was shuttered after about when I was 5, 6 years old. They closed up. So then, and all of a sudden, the cashier said, oh, yeah, I remember that congregation. I also lived in Albany Park, and I used to hang out by the Deborah Boys Club, which was like a youth center where we would get kids off the street. And all of a sudden, everybody started talking about the old hangouts in Albany Park and the L line. And I looked at my watch and it was now 5 minutes. So I said to the cashier, I said, you know, I really have to get home before sundown. Do you think that you could, finish checking me out? Oh, yes, yes, of course. So she checked me out. I turned to Karen and I said, well, it's nice to see you. Have a good weekend. And she, with a voice of indignance, she said, mean have a good Shabbos, Rabbi. Now, of course, she wasn't going to get home in time for Shabbos. She was not Shomer Shabbos. But she was correct. I shouldn't greet her like that. So I said, yes, you're right. Have a good Shabbos. And I took my bag of groceries, and I was running out the door, and I literally was able to hear in the background, so have a good Shabbos, Karen. Have a good Shabbos, Sam. And everyone was wishing good Shabbos. Okay. I get back to the seed house. It took me 2 minutes to drive over. The first thing my wife wanted to know is, you've just been getting 3 items. What took so long? So I told you, no, it's an interesting story. I'll tell it over at the meal. Okay. I told it over at the meal, and that was the end of the story. A week later, an envelope comes in the mail addressed to Project Seed. I open it up. There was a paper in there from this Karen. And I saved the paper, but I'm going to read it to you. I know if I had, she said, Rabbi Miller, when I saw you last week, last Friday afternoon in Shul, I was there to purchase a Sara Lee banana cake, which is my daughter's favorite, in honor of her scoring a 795 on her SAT math scores, which is one of the highest scores you can get. As a result of that score, she was eligible to be enrolled in MIT, where she actually graduated from MIT with honors. But after our pleasant conversation, I told the cashier to put the cake away. Because how can I celebrate such an accomplishment by buying a treif cake? And instead, I'm sending Project Seed this donation to thank Hashem for the mind he gave my daughter. I want you to know, when I read the letter, my hand was shaking. I never noticed the cake. I didn't even notice it. And it's not like I gave her any kind of a dirty look about it. Today, it's about 20 years later, this lady and her daughter, who's since married and raising her own family, today, both of them have a kosher kitchen and are both Shomer Shabbos. All because I was just pleasant. I didn't even speak about kashrus. I was just pleasant. I took an interest. I said her name, and I took an interest. I remembered her voice. I took an interest, and she did it on her own. The neshama can guide a person back to Torah as long as they're treated with respect. These techniques are incredibly powerful. If you learn them and master them, you will influence yourself, you will influence and change your world, and you will change the entire world. Learn them, use them. Thank you for listening. Anyone has any questions? For a few minutes, I can answer.